Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Well, good morning and welcome to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour. I'm Harry Miller.
And I'm Jane Marie Schaefer.
And Jane Marie and I, we are two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm. We have four conveniently located offices in starting from north to south, Saratoga Springs, New York, Clifton Park, Albany, and Kingston. And we are here each Saturday morning from 8 to 9 o'clock to chat with you, primarily to answer your questions and your phone calls. And in between, we'll give you some interesting information you can think about and put to good use in estate planning, asset protection planning, estate administration, beneficiary designations, gift. We're in the last quarter of the year, right?
Gosh, that's October. That's right. Yep, October. So thinking about planning for the year, right? Taxes and things like that.
Well, yeah, it's never too late to start year-end planning, and kind of the last quarter we're thinking about. I mean, the holidays are coming up. I don't know. It's going to be a little different this year than in previous years, I guess, with the COVID virus. You know, we're not going to have. I don't know. Maybe we are. We're not going to have enormous family gatherings and large Christmas parties this year, I don't think. But the, you know, estate planning and end of year tax planning is still an important thing that people are going to do, no matter what we're doing socially, and you know. So if you got questions about those, about, you know, gift giving, this is a time people are going to think about making gifts to their kids and stuff like that. We can help you out with things like that and checking out your beneficiary designations. Now, we have, if you're a regular listener, we've been doing, by the way, if you want to call us, let me give you the phone number, huh? We are here until 9 o'clock, so you can reach Jane Marie and I in the studio and be our first caller if you pick up the phone and dial 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. So do you want to tell, do you have the webinar schedule? Well, next Wednesday, do you got the schedule there, Jane Marie? We've got two webinars coming up.
Yes, we do our webinars every Wednesday, and this Wednesday, October 14th, we have two webinars in the morning. We have How to Plan Your Estate at 10 o'clock, and we're talking about how to set up your estate plan if you don't have one, you know, how to put it together, or even if you have one, you know, what you need to make sure that you've included or to review and make sure you have everything you need. And then at 2 o'clock, we have Aging in Place. One of our more popular ones, how to stay at home and receive care rather than go to a nursing home. And to register for either of those, you can go to our website at www.herzoglaw.com, and you can register there. And then you'll get a link to join the webinar. I think people are pretty used to Zoom now, so it's going to be a Zoom webinar, and you can get right on.
Yeah, it's great. And and I think the thing is, even if you don't have Zoom, or you don't, you can still. I mean, if you don't have the video thing, you can still listen to it. You know, you wouldn't actually see the presenters, but you can still listen to it like on your cell phone, even if you don't. So there are lots of ways that
people call in. Yes, we do, and you can just listen right in. Or I want to mention that those times aren't good for you. You can go onto our website and go on the blog section. And on there, we have recorded webinars from the past that you can watch at your convenience whenever you want.
Right. You're going to get a blast from the past. definitely.
That's right.
Super. So be sure to take advantage of those, because a lot of people, it's really nice, because a lot of people are, are sitting around a lot of time on their hands right now, and I can't tell you how many different clients and people and not clients have told me over the last couple of months how, you know, they call up and they say, gee, I was looking at your webinar the other day, and it provokes questions that people have about things. And so, you know, it's okay to call us and ask us those questions. It's it's fine with us. Hey, something interesting. If you haven't got your, this has nothing to do with estate planning. It has to do with your health. If you haven't got your flu shot already, for heaven's sakes, get your flu shot. I don't know. I mean, I don't think here. I got mine about 2 weeks ago, but I haven't heard of any shortages yet of the flu. Have you? I mean, Jay Marie, your husband's a doctor. You're not experiencing any flu shortages, flu vaccine shortages. No.
I haven't heard of any shortages yet, but I still wouldn't recommend that you get it early so that doesn't happen, Although, to be honest, I haven't gotten mine yet. Maybe that's something I will do this weekend.
Well, you can just go to the drugstore, at the grocery store and get them there. And, of course, if you're over 65 like I am, you get the super-duper, what do they call the thing, the flu max.
That's so long.
It's a heavy duty flu shot. It's for all people, like me. Flu Zone is called Fluad. Flu Zone High Dose. If you're over 65, Jane Marie doesn't qualify for that for another decade or two.
Thank you. That's very generous.
Two decades. It's quite a while before she's going to be 65. But hey, here's the neat thing I read not too long ago. There have been some tests conducted, some research conducted, both at the University of Texas and also at Duke University and UNC. And they have found that people who get flu shots regularly have a substantially reduced likelihood of developing Alzheimer's disease. Did you know that?
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
So they did a study, like 9,000 people who were at least 60 years old, and some got a regular flu shot and some didn't. And they found that people who got at least one flu shot reduced their risk of Alzheimer's by 17%. And if you got regular ones every year, it went down another 13%. And those people who got, have you ever had a pneumonia shot, Jane Marie? Probably not.
No, I haven't had that. No.
My wife, we have those once in a while. They'll give those every year, like maybe every 5 years or something. But people who've gotten a pneumonia shot before they turn 75 were 25% less likely to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So that's pretty interesting. So there can be some added bonuses in addition to reducing your risk of getting the flu. But what I was going to say is our friends in North Carolina, and I have a little place down in North Carolina, and we've talked to some friends down there, and in the South, at least where we are, there are some places that are actually running out of the flu vaccine. So I don't know I don't think that's hit up here yet. I haven't heard anything about that, but there certainly is no reason to dawdle. So go out and get it. Hey, Ben, have you got your flu shot yet?
No, but actually we're going today.
All right. There you go.
Good. That's good. Well, the chilly weather has made us all think about winter, so if it makes you think of winter, it's a good time to go get this done.
It is. So, once again, 476-5900, 476-5900 is our number here in the studio. Apropos... talk for a few minutes about beneficiary designations. I just wanted to point out the importance of making sure that you check and recheck the various beneficiaries on your different assets, like insurance policies, like life insurance policies, and annuity policies, and IRAs. I had a situation recently. Client called me up, and his father had died probably more than a year ago. And he had a small IRA. It wasn't a huge amount of money. It was just a small amount of money in it. Okay? And so the son was trying to, roll it over into, or take a distribution. And so guess what happened? He called me. The beneficiary on his father's IRA was his mother. Okay?
Right.
Who died 24 years ago.
Oh, boy.
Okay? So there's this little IRA sitting out there. 24 years ago, the father forgot or just never got around to changing the beneficiary. Now, okay, we have to go ahead and reopen. Now, the estate has been closed, the father's estate. Now we got to reopen the estate and get certificate of letters and take the distribution through the estate. So we're going to have to open up an estate account and do all that. A lot of added rigmarole that could have been easily avoided by just regularly checking who the beneficiaries are, and particularly if they've passed away, we want to make sure that they're not on the account. And there was no alternate beneficiary, okay?
Right. That's the other thing. You should have a contingent beneficiary on there, and that could have avoided this problem by putting a backup beneficiary. Right.
Yeah, the father could have put mom first and the son second, okay? And then we wouldn't have had this problem either, but they didn't do. And the other part of the problem is, Jay Marie, you know, when people name these beneficiary forms initially, when they initially open the IRA or they initially buy the life insurance policy, you know who's talking to them about beneficiaries? It's not us. It's not talking to a lawyer about who the beneficiary should be. They're talking to some sales guy, you know, who sells insurance or annuities or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're not estate planning guidance people, although some of them think they are. and they don't understand the ramifications of just, or they just put down a beneficiary. And so that's part of the problem is running into these people. And I'm not, you know, every time you buy one of these products, you don't necessarily need to talk to your lawyer, but you ought to keep it in mind. And if you're not sure, you ought to talk to your lawyer and find out who the best person to name is the beneficiary.
Harry and Jay Marie.
Yeah, sure.
We have our first caller this morning. We have Steve in Red Hook.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. I wonder what happens to the assets outside of a trust, like if you have a vacation home and, you know, money and, you know, stuff like that. What happens to that? Can it be preserved?
Go ahead, Harry.
No, I mean, a vacation home that's not in the trust?
Yeah.
Oh, often we would put it in the trust anyway. I have clients who have two or three houses, and we normally would put them all into the same trust. Vacation homes are interesting because, you know, they're often the family, you know, mom and dad usually want to preserve the vacation home on the lake or someplace so that everybody, the kids and the grandkids, always love up. Coming up and visiting, and it works really good, I find, as long as grandma and grandpa are paying the bills and paying the taxes. Once that stops, you know, if you got three kids, invariably one of them doesn't want to kick in their share of the taxes and the insurance of the repairs. We work with that for folks who have those things. I mean, if the vacation home, where it would go would be governed then by the will. If it was in joint names with you, Steve, if it was in joint names with you and a spouse, on the death of the first spouse, it would automatically be owned by the second spouse. Mm-hmm. But then when the second spouse dies, if it's not in a trust, then the will is going to have to be probated in order to either sell the place or transfer it through the will to the children. Mm-hmm. So there's an added expense there. And if the vacation house is in another state, now you've got to do two probate proceedings. You first have to probate your will in New York, and then if you have a vacation home in Vermont, or if you've got a condominium down in Florida, now we're going to have to go down to Florida and hire yet another Florida law firm to do, and that's a proceeding that's called ancillary probate. Mm-hmm. And it has to be done, particularly in a situation where you're transferring a piece of real property.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it pays to put it in a trust, then.
Yeah, it definitely pays to put it in a trust because that way you avoid probate in both states. You know, I have, as I was just talking earlier about the flu shot thing, I have a house here in New York, and I have a house in North Carolina. Both of those houses are in a trust that my wife and I set up, you know, many years ago.
Yeah.
So even though they would be in joint names, so whichever of us dies first, the surviving spouse would own the house. When you have to probate the will is when the second spouse passes away.
Okay.
So it's really critically important to, yeah, to try to avoid those things, yeah.
What about other assets that are not in a trust? Do they need to be probated?
Well, yes, Dame Marie, why don't you pick up on that one?
Yeah, sure. So the other assets, it kind of depends on what type they are. So there are assets that you know that you can have beneficiary designations. We were just talking about those. So that's typically life insurance or annuities or IRAs. And they're going to go to your beneficiary, and hopefully, you know, you have updated beneficiaries and contingent beneficiaries so that it goes to the right people. But if you have other assets that don't have a beneficiary on it and it's not in your trust, again, it goes under the terms of your will. So you would have to probate the will to distribute those assets to the beneficiaries that you want to.
Yeah, but what about how the nursing home, do they have access to these annuities, even though they have beneficiaries on them?
Oh, sure, yeah. They're beneficiaries, the only advantage of having a beneficiary on a bank account or a mutual fund account is to pass it on death without probate. But that doesn't protect it if you wind up in a nursing home while you're alive, you know.
Okay.
And then you'll spend it all. There won't be anything left to pass to the beneficiary because you'll have spent it all in the nursing home. So you really, in those situations, you have to set up an asset protection trust and put the real estate and the, you know, the asset levels. For a married couple in New York can keep a house, one house, with their principal residence, as long as it's worth less than $850,000. And in addition, between the two of them, they can keep another $90,000. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, however, if you're single or widowed, forget that. You get to keep about $15,000. And everything else...
You should get married.
Well, there are situations where that has happened, where we've had, for instance, a couple who are in a non-marital relationship. Frankly, if they got married, the husband has to go in the nursing home, and they get married, all of a sudden the house becomes a non-countable resource. It's exempt for the other spouse, and your resource level goes up to almost $100,000. So it doesn't happen often, but on occasion, we could certainly want to look at that. Yeah.
It could go the other way, too. They could get a divorce and one take all the assets if one the other goes in a nursing home.
That's true. That has also happened on occasion. That's fairly rare also, but has to be a real divorce, though. In other words, the county social services doesn't recognize sham divorces. So if you divorce your wife because she was in a nursing home, and you all keep living in the same house and you still have a joint bank account, it's not going to work. The county is not going to. They're not going to recognize that as a real divorce. You actually have to
fly.
Move out.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening, Steve. It's always a pleasure talking with you. 476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. I don't know if we have our... Do we use the outside line anymore, the long-distance line?
Or? We do not. We use 518-476-5900. That's it.
Right. I didn't say it because you told me a few weeks ago that was kaput or something.
You are very good, Harry. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Just get your flu shot, Ben.
That's right. I'm getting it today.
Okay. So I wanted to talk a couple of minutes this morning... about something. I know a lot of you out there have occasionally, through the course of raising your children and also mostly after they become adults, Sometimes one of them needs, you know, some financial assistance, all right? Maybe they're getting divorced, and they got a big legal bill, or they need, you know, assistance with support. Maybe they maybe they're going to college or graduate school, and the other one isn't, and we're helping them out. Maybe we want to give somebody, you know, $20,000-$30,000, give a kid for a down payment on a house or something like that. How do we deal? We got to deal with these things in a way, because many of us want to help our children financially if we're in a position to do that. But we also want to keep all the kids equal, right, Jane Marie? So yeah, you've got three kids, and let's say one of them at some point along the way got mom and dad just made, you know, they helped them out, gave them $50,000, all right? And I use the word gave. I use the word gave lightly because because what happens down the road here is the parents at some point may have expected this would be repaid over time or whenever, and of course it rarely is. So now at the end of the day, if we leave a will or a trust that leaves everything in equal shares to the three kids. Well, the one kid's got, at the end of the day, sort of raked up $50,000 more than his brother and sister. So how do you deal with that? We're talking about, you know, one of our webinars, you know, making an estate. How do we do that in terms of making a really good estate plan that's fair to everybody?
Sure. So you certainly can take care of that, and you just have to use careful language when you're drafting your will. And that's called an advancement when you give. It can be considered an advancement on your inheritance, right? So they're giving you $50,000 against your one-third share that you're going to get. So when we write up the will, we would say that it's distributed equally, but that one child share is going to be reduced by any advancements that were made to him or her, right, during the parent's lifetime.
Exactly.
So that keeps it even, right? So, and it's generally, you know, for larger amounts of money, not for little amounts of money.
No, I'm not talking about a couple $1,000s here and there. I mean, everybody, you know, might do that from time to time. But if we're making the major contribution to somebody, one thing I try to encourage the client to do, first of all, is to have the child acknowledge the fact that this is an advancement. It is not a gift, all right? And sometimes it's a loan. Sometimes I will have the child will sign a promissory note, okay? Or something at least acknowledging the debt and that it is a debt, not a gift. Because memories quickly fade when mom and dad are out of the picture, right? Your sister finds out that mom and dad gave you an extra $50,000. Of course. No, I was never supposed to pay that back, right? No, that was mom wanted me. She wanted me to have that.
That's right. So it's better to have that documented, I guess, when you give the gift, right? And make it clear whether you expect to be repaid or not.
Yes, because sometimes it is a gift. Sometimes the parent wants the child to have the funds, and they have no expectation that they'll be paid back or that there'll be any adjustment. So I guess what we're trying to get people to focus on is what is your particular desire here? If it's a gift, then it's a gift. And in those situations, I encourage the client to write what we call a gift letter. So, you know, dear Susie, you know, Dad and I have decided to give you $50,000 toward the down payment on the new house you're buying. You know, it's a gift. We don't expect it to be repaid, and we don't expect it to be adjusted down the road. But if we do expect it to be adjusted down the road, then at the end of the day, when we're divvying up the third to each kid, we're going to put that $50,000 in Susie's column, okay? Because she already got it. And everything else is going to be all right. So at the end of the day, if she hasn't repaid it, And I always put language in the will also that usually says, you know, during my lifetime, I have made an advancement to my daughter in the amount of X number of dollars, whatever it is. And then I also say, you know, if that hasn't been repaid, or if it hasn't been fully repaid to me at the time of my death. Because sometimes kids do. I've had situations where parents have actually set it up like a loan, and they, you know, amortized it over 5 years or 10 years. So if Susie paid back $25,000 of the $50,000, well, we're not going to treat her as having received $50,000. She only left. There's $25,000 that hasn't come back to mom and dad. So there are lots of different ways of dealing with this problem. But from a standpoint of parents, it's really a good idea to address it up front with the kids if you're going to do that, because here's what happens down the road. It creates a lot of resentment, animosity, and bad feeling among your kids. Okay.
And I can attest to that, having done a lot of the probates. I do more of those in our practice. And on the other side, there is a lot of fighting. I guess there's no other word for it.
But it is.
Fighting. Right, among the children when they feel like they were treated unfairly by mom and dad. And it always helps if mom and dad had written something out or left a note, you know. Well, I mean, it doesn't always help, but it helps, you know, explain why one child was treated differently. But we end up in court several times trying to, you know, settle things about why one kid wasn't left anything or why one kid was left more than the other. And you don't really want your children to have to go through that, fighting this out in court. You know, sometimes it ruins family relationships.
Oh, it's awful. It's absolutely awful. And it can be avoided. It can be avoided. But down the road, boy, when the kids find out, and they will, eventually somebody will find out about this. And it's just not a good thing. Now, you know, and there's times when, the correlative side, as opposed to helping a kid out with a down payment on a house or some other financial need that they have, we're finding increasingly situations where mom and dad want one of the kids to receive more than the other because they've done more work in taking care of mom and dad, okay? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't always go over so big anyway, either, do you think?
No, it doesn't. There's usually one child who is the caregiver who maybe lives with mom or dad and is doing a lot more than the other siblings.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's justified, I, in my opinion, to give them a little bit extra. But the other children do not always agree with that.
No, you got two kids, and one of them, the caretaker child, and it's usually a daughter. It's rarely a son, is running into the grocery store, taking mom to all of her doctor's appointments. You know, she's bringing meals over. She's, you know, taking care of her. And the other kid shows up, you know, twice a year. Increasingly, parents, and so maybe instead of splitting it 50-50, they want to split it 60-40. The point is, not that you shouldn't do that. The point is that you ought to explain it. The best thing is to explain it while you're alive.
Yeah.
Some people are uncomfortable or unwilling to do that. Short of that, at least write it down in a letter in your own handwriting, explaining carefully why you did what you did, because it will help avoid bad feeling and animosity between those two kids down the road.
And it is the bottom of the hour. We're going to take our break right here. We'll be back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for,
options available for Medicaid planning, and more.
With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany,
West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs,
Executive Woods in Clifton Park,
and Flatbush Road in Kingston.
Our attorneys are here to help you.
If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David,
Jane Marie Harry, or Debbie,
please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581.
Our Saratoga Springs office at 518-581-8131.
Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010.
And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405.
Let the Herzog Law Firm help you navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And welcome back to the second half hour of the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour. I am Harry Miller.
And I'm Jane Marie Schaefer.
And Jane Marie and I are two of the attorneys with the Herzog Law Firm here at Corporate Woods in Albany, New York. We have offices in Kingston, Clifton Park, and Saratoga Springs as well. So you can see us, any of us, in any of our offices. I don't know. I think Jane Marie's been down to the Kingston office once or twice, haven't you?
Oh, yes. I've been down there. I've been to there. I was just there 2 weeks ago. So.
Yeah. They do. Yeah. David's there most of the time. I think Debbie may be the only person who's not been in the Kingston office.
She is. That's right.
She still is. But she holds down the Saratoga office.
That's right.
She's there more than anybody else.
That's right.
Definitely. We'd love to talk to you. What's that?
We have some territories, but all four of us go to all four offices if we need to. So.
We do indeed. So we'd love to talk to you this morning if you have a question about estate planning, asset protection planning, Medicaid planning, estate administration, any of those things related to the topics we talk about here. Pick up the phone, please, and call Jane Marie and I at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. We'd love to talk to you. Okay, what do you want to chat about?
So when we were just talking about, giving more to one child who is a caregiver, I wanted to talk about that in the Medicaid context, because that can have some benefits to you when you're planning for Medicaid.
Yeah.
So normally, if you're gifting money to any one of your children, right, that's going to count against you if you apply for Medicaid later on. There's going to be a penalty assessed with that transfer if it was done within the 5 years before the time you need to go to a nursing home, or as of now, of the 2.5 years before you apply for community Medicaid. But there are some exceptions to that. And one of the exceptions is a gift of your home to a caregiver child. So if your child moves into your home and takes care of you, and they've been doing that for at least 2 years, you're allowed to make a transfer of that house to the caregiver child, and that's not going to be penalized for Medicaid purposes. And we see that happen a lot. A lot of times there is one child who is able to help stay with mom and dad and keep them out of the nursing home for a while, by living there, or keep them out of the nursing home completely, right, by living there and helping to take care of them.
Oh, absolutely. And you got it. Now, in that situation, the child who's taking care of mom or dad has to move into mom or dad's house, right, and take care of them in their house, right?
Yes, that's so, right. They have to move into the house, yes, and take care of them in mom and dad's house.
Right. Sometimes mom or dad moves into the child's house, all right? Now, that doesn't work from a standpoint of divvying up the house, but one of the things, if mom or dad moved into the child's house, well, chances are they might sell the house they're living in. Another way to help protect some of the assets, if it's working that way, mom and dad could buy a life estate. They could purchase a life estate in their child's home. Mm-hmm. And I've done this on a number of occasions. And if they live there, I think it's either a year or two, is it? If they buy a life estate in mom and dad's house and they live there for, it might be 2 years. I think it might be, it's either 1 year or 2 years. I have to check again. Then, again, the purchase of that life estate is not considered an uncompensated transfer. So we'll look at those things, and occasionally that's another way to work it in reverse.
Well, that makes sense. A lot of time the child, when mom and dad is moving in with them, they don't necessarily have a separate living space. So they're going to add an in-law suite, right, or extra space for them. So they may build an addition onto the house, or they may fix up the basement. So if the parents are giving them money towards that, that can be an exempt transfer if you do what Harry says and you purchase a life estate.
Right, and we've had those situations on occasion where we built, you build an addition onto the house for mom and dad. You build, bedroom, a little den. You could spend, $50,000, $60,000, $100,000. Again, you could. That's a way to spend down assets that would otherwise have to be contributed toward nursing home costs. So, I mean, I think one of the things we're trying to point out here is in those situations where you have a fair amount of assets you want to try to shelter, it's really important that you consult with a law firm like ours, who has a lot of depth and a lot of experience in the Medicaid asset protection planning. I've had many situations where a client has gone to a lawyer wanting to do something, and the lawyer has said, "Oh, you can't do that."
Right.
And then they came to us and they said, "Well, that isn't really quite correct. You actually can do it, and here's how you can do it in terms of protecting assets." And it's simply a matter of the fact that many of the lawyers who do perfectly fine jobs of estate planning and wills and trusts and healthcare powers of attorney don't focus their practice on the Medicaid side, which is a whole subset of it's a whole little boutique practice that we're pretty well versed in. And so the other thing we were going to talk about was if you have a child, for instance, who's caring for you, like Jamie was talking about, you can enter into a caretaker agreement with that child and transfer a significant amount of assets. And these are calculated actuarially based on the cost of the care, the compensation, and the age of the parent. And if it's done correctly, you could transfer the equivalent of a couple $100,000 from a parent to a caretaker child in exchange for their commitment to take care of you for the rest of your life. And again, that's a legitimate transfer that's not going to be penalized if you have to go to a nursing home at some point and apply for Medicaid, all right, or even for home care, I suppose, yeah.
That's right. All right, these kind of go above and beyond just the traditional kind of transferring assets to a trust. So that's why it is great to work with someone like us, because we have lots of different tools that are at our hand to help you with Medicaid planning.
The kind of techniques and planning techniques that Jane Marie are talking about now are the ones where we put the assets in a trust. Well, that's fine, but we may not have 5 years, all right? We may not be able to wait 5 years before we have to apply for Medicaid, either for home care or for nursing home care. And so these are ways that you can sort of short-circuit the five-year look-back by having a caretaker agreement or the purchase of a life estate in a child's house or the caregiver exemption where you can deed your house to a caretaker child. Because we're talking about either no penalty or having to wait a year or two instead of 5 years. And so many of these techniques are, they're all authorized in the social service regulations. But if you don't do a lot of planning like this, sometimes folks are just unaware of these situations. And God forbid you go and let the nursing home people do your Medicaid application. That's just a foolish decision, unless there are no assets. If you have no assets and you're simply filling out the application, fine. But if you have assets that need to be protected or might have to be spent down in some fashion, or worse yet, you have transferred assets within the last 5 years, and guess what? The person who's doing the application for the nursing home didn't bother to ask you that question. You can really you can really stub your toe real hard.
I think it happens almost every week that I hear of someone who either got a Medicaid denial because the nursing home applied for them, or they were spending a lot of money to pay the nursing home, and without really knowing that there were other options. And sometimes we hear this in time to help them, Sometimes I've heard it where that, oh, we paid so much money for mom or dad, or and we lost all that money, right? And it's too late.
We've had some. Not too long ago, I had a situation where the client came to us after this person, this non-lawyer person, whoever the nursing home used, had filed the application. And there had been prior transfers, which were going to result, you know, within 5 years, there had been some uncompensated transfers. And they were going to result in a substantial penalty for the client. So... Here, right. Where they actually, where they filed, what we did was we withdrew the application because it had been filed with the county, but they hadn't acted on it yet.
Mm-hmm.
So in that situation, if we can withdraw the application before they impose the penalty, then we can go back and do the planning like we were talking about and then refile it at the appropriate time so we don't create the penalty or create a shorter penalty than would have been created otherwise. It's just, this stuff is complicated, folks. And,
right.
It requires, you wouldn't go climb Mount Everest without a Sherpa, you know. So think of us as your Sherpa. You know? Have that one, Ben.
I like it.
That's a good one.
There you go. You know, I should have gone into more advertising or something like that. You know, anyway. So 476-5900, 476-5900. Love to talk to you here. Coming up on sort of quarter till the hour. And gorgeous Saturday morning. You must, you know, the leaves here aren't all that, I mean, they're okay, but they're not, you're probably over in Massachusetts, you probably have beautiful, you're a little up higher than we are here.
We are. I would say we're at peak. We have beautiful colors right now. If you want to take a ride this weekend, you know, ride over to the Berkshires, you can see some beautiful foliage. Really nice.
Leaf peepers. Yes, leaf peepers will be out.
But why take a ride when we can take a phone call? Here
there
is Jim from Waterford, and then we've got a caller right behind them.
Okay. Hey, Jim. How are you?
Good, good. I wanted to ask you, I have a trust, and half of my money is in the trust, and half of it isn't.
Yeah.
The part that's not in the trust, would that have to be probated?
Well, it depends how it's owned. If it's just in your name, probably yes. Yeah. Do you have a spouse?
Yes, but she's has dementia.
Okay. How about children? You could put it in beneficiary form if you have children or whoever you would want to get the funds, and that would avoid probate. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, if you, did you say you had children?
I have children, yes. I have four living children, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, if those accounts were in your name or even joint names with your wife, you could go to the bank and put the four kids on as beneficiaries. So that would mean, in other words, it's still your money. They can't go to the bank and withdraw the money, all right? If you put them on as joint owners, they could. But if you put them on as beneficiaries, then they can go to the bank after you pass away with a death certificate and get the money without going to probate, all right?
Okay. All right.
So you could go next time you go to the bank. If you want to do that, you could sit down with the branch manager or the assistant branch manager, and you can fill out a form putting those kids on as beneficiaries, and that will avoid having to probate. Now, when a person dies, if they have, we can transfer what is it, $30,000 to a spouse.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's been raised.
With an affidavit,
to $50,000.
So
recently.
We can transfer up to $50,000 of assets with a very simplified proceeding, in New York State. But if it's more than that, then you'd have to do a full blown probate proceeding, which is going to cost you probably several thousand dollars. So you can save your kids a lot of money by doing this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Would that wouldn't be? When I had the trust on, I have a will like in the trust. That wouldn't be in the will. That would be separate.
It would. It would. If you have a beneficiary on an asset, the beneficiary trumps the will. All right. So if you have a life insurance, if you got a $10,000 life insurance policy, and it's payable on death to your son, if he's the beneficiary, it doesn't matter what the will says. All right.
Okay.
It's going to go to the beneficiary. If you have an IRA account or like a 401k through your work. That has a beneficiary on it, and the money is going to go to the beneficiary no matter what your will or your trust says. The only time it's going to go through the will is if the beneficiary that you named dies before you do and there's no contingent secondary beneficiary.
Okay, thank you. Then if you had a lot of money, say you had $200,000, and you had four children, you would put four accounts with 50,
yeah.
50 mm-hmm. beneficiary, one 50 with the beneficiary for four different accounts.
You can do that, right? Too, yeah. You can do it, yeah.
That's an easy way to keep it clean. Yeah.
You could do it, or you could keep it in one account. You could keep it on one account with the four kids on as beneficiaries of the single account. Might be easier to have one account than four accounts. And what they happen when they, you know, I did this when my... when my mother passed away about 10 years ago, I have two sisters. So her bank accounts that weren't in her trust were payable on death to me and my two sisters. So when she passed away, we just went to the bank with the death certificate. They closed out the account and cut a check to each of us for one-third of the account. So it was simple. No probate.
Okay. All right. I appreciate it. I wasn't sure how that worked out.
It's better. I think it's better to put beneficiaries on the accounts.
I had them in CDs, and when the CD ran out, and then they'd say, "Do you want to renew it?" And I'd say, "Yes, but I wanted to put my child, my daughter, or my son on it," and they didn't want to put them on it because they're not with you or something. They have to go into the bank or prove that they're who they are or show their Social Security number.
Yeah. But that's different. I think what the bank there was talking to was adding them on as a joint account owner. All right?
Yeah.
They shouldn't have to. Do you think, Jane, they don't have to sign anything for you to put them on as a beneficiary?
No. Because frankly, I believe that's just when it's a joint owner.
Yeah. Because if they don't need to sign anything if they're the beneficiary. Because you could change it. If you have your kids on as beneficiary and for some reason you want to remove one of them, you can do that, and your kids don't have to, they don't get a vote. It's still your money. You know?
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you.
All right, and we have Wayne from Schenectady on the line.
Good morning.
Good morning, Wayne.
Hi.
How are you? I've had the pleasure of dealing with Jane Marie, and your firm's amazing.
Thank you.
My question is, when, at what age should you be planning? I'm in a situation where my father-in-law passed away and left considerable assets to me and my son. I'm 64, I know, and in good health, but I know at some point, protecting these assets are going to be vital. Do you have an age that you suggest people should be doing this before the five-year look back?
I would think that you're kind of in that age period. In your 60s or kind of around the time you're retiring, that's really the time that a lot of people do start to think about this. Not that you're going to need help in 5 years, hopefully not, but it's a good time to start planning for that. And if you do plan and, you know, maybe you move your house into a trust, that's really not as hard. Then you're not giving up a lot of control when you put your house into a trust because you keep rights to live in the house. You have a life use over the house. You may not want to put your money in a trust right away. But the good thing about planning is you can start a trust earlier on and then make additions to it as you get older. So it's a process. So I think of it as start the process, you know, in your 60s, you know, and then set up a trust, and then you can always add to it later on. That's one suggestion I have. Because if you keep waiting, you may miss that opportunity to get that five-year period in there.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You listen to our theme song in a way, and you're the age of the guy that's on our theme song from the Beatles, you know, when I'm 64.
Yeah.
Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Yeah, that's very accurate. The show's great, and I really appreciate you guys doing it.
Well, we have fun. We enjoy it, and hopefully it's helpful and informative to people. We've been, I was telling Ben earlier, I think we started, this firm started doing radio about 40 years ago, around 1980. Mm-hmm. Our retired partner, Sholem Kapovitz, started doing a radio show locally, and, you know, various combinations of us, he retired about 10, 12 years ago, have continued it on, and I think it's, people seem to enjoy it, and I think it's hopefully helpful and informative for everybody. So thank you for the compliment. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Have a great day.
Take care. Have a great
Take care.
Good question.
I think that question, you know, 64, you don't feel these days. I mean, maybe when the Beatles wrote that song, 64, older, right?
When the Beatles wrote that song about 30 or 40 years, it could be that they wrote that song was written in the 60s, which is, you know, what are we talking about? 50, that's 50 years ago, for heaven's sakes. And I think I read somewhere that when they made that song, When I'm 64, that was sort of like the media, you know, that was like the median age of life expectancy in England in the early to mid 1960s, and now it's probably close to 80.
It's around 80, right? So the times have changed, right?
So times have changed, and you know that the gentleman who we just talked to, I mean, he's 64 and he's in good health for a 64-year-old. He's probably looking at living at least another 20 years, you know, maybe more. Who knows?
That's right. But on the other hand, it doesn't hurt to get your legal stuff in place when you're that age.
Yeah, and the planning is an ongoing estate planning is an ongoing process. It really can begin when you're quite young.
Yes.
I mean, he was really talking more elder law planning, but you know, a young married couple who have a baby and they're in their 20s or early 30s needs an estate plan. They need a will that even if they don't have a lot of accumulated assets, you know, they got a big mortgage and a lot of student debt, they don't have a lot of net worth maybe at this point. But if for no other reason, they need a will that names a guardian for their child. If,
yes,
God forbid, something happens and they both perish in an accident or something, they ought to decide who's going to raise the kid.
Right. And a lot of young couples, like you said, they may not have a lot of wealth, but they may have a lot of life insurance. And that life insurance money is going to, you know, be used to take care of your children. So you need to have a will to name not just a guardian, but a trustee over the money to manage the money for your children. And we do a lot of planning like that for younger couples. I have a couple who's really prepared. She's expecting a child, and they're coming in to do a will without guardians and trustees. So
exactly.
It's always great to do that planning ahead of time.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, in a sense, estate planning is sort of a lifelong process. I mean, from the time you turn in, I'm sorry, but if you have an 18-year-old child or an 18-year-old grandchild who is off to college, particularly in this era of COVID virus, that kid needs, if nothing else, maybe they don't need a will yet, but they need a healthcare proxy and they need a power of attorney. Because you have no, if your kid is, you know, out at the University of Illinois or at, you know, University of Southern California, and they contract the COVID virus, you have no legal authority without a health care proxy and a power of attorney to manage their health care other than emergency types of treatments. It's really critically important that you get these kids these documents. because they, you know, we want them safe and healthy, but occasionally things happen, and they have accidents, they contract illnesses, and, you know, we don't want to be the bearer of doom and gloom, but if, God forbid, something like it does happen, we don't want to complicate the emotional trauma of the illness or the accident with now having all this legal rigmarole that we have to go through because we don't have these documents. We have to do a guardianship proceeding someplace in order to just take care of our kids. It's so critically important, especially as we come up to the, you know, the end of the year, we're going into the winter. I don't know.
I think it's important because I have college-age children who are now both.
That's
older.
Right, yeah.
If they're at college and something happened, I wouldn't be able to get any information absent these documents. So you need to have these documents just to be able to, you know, talk to the doctors or, you know, talk to the hospital. In fact, they're pediatricians, you know. Now that they're 18, I'm not allowed to get any information from the pediatrician. They find a release, you know, unless they sign a release to let that doctor talk to me.
I'm sure yours have, huh?
Yes, they have.
Only if you're going to write the tuition check in January for the second semester, right?
That's right. No, they both willingly signed it. I didn't twist any arms.
You made an offer they couldn't refuse, right, Jamie?
That's right. That's right.
Anyway, so I think I guess we are at the top of the hour, aren't we? Okay. Sounds like we're out of time, Jamie Marie, so
right.
Talk to you next week.
Have
a great weekend. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.